Hello and welcome to the inaugural Society for U.S. Intellectual History podcast. My name is Matthew Linton, and I'm a doctoral candidate in history at Brandeis University. I'm very excited today to be joined by Andrew Seal. Andrew, could you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Andrew Seal. I'm a PhD candidate in American Studies at Yale University. I'm glad to be joining you.
Great. So in this episode, we're going to be looking at two topics. The first one is Mark Greif's new book, The Age of the Crisis of Man, Thought and Fiction in America, 1933 to 1973. That's a 2015 publication, which has come out from Princeton University Press. Greif is a professor of literary studies at the New School in New York City. So, Andrew, you wrote a wonderful review of this book that I think we'll use as the jumping point for the off point for this discussion. So in your review, why don't you just give us a brief summary or overview of what you see the kind of principal arguments or claims that Greif is making?
Well, I think that the principal argument is that there's this whole almost continent of discourse that intellectual historians, literary historians, cultural historians, not just of the United States, but of the Atlantic world more generally, perhaps, have missed or have not seen as a cohesive discourse. And I think that that's an incredibly exciting project to be reading, to be encountering. It's a remarkable book, full of just incredible insights, very local insights, and also this larger framework. I think Greif takes a look at a number of texts that have been perhaps put to the side or assumed to have less to contribute as texts and more as sort of signposts of a moment that has passed. And interestingly, and I think that not just in my post, but in two previous reviews that appeared on the USIH blog, a sense of ambivalence on the part of Greif really came through to all three of us as to whether this this discourse really needed to be reclaimed as something to be studied intensively, or if it was indeed something that could be sort of boxed up and put in the attic of intellectual history again once we recognize that it actually existed. And so that makes the book a challenging read in terms of the relationship between the author and the content. I don't know, did you get the same sense in terms of Greif's tone, of his approach to his material?
Yeah, I mean, I found it to be a very challenging book. As somebody who comes at intellectual history not from a literature background and not being familiar at all with the majority of the texts that he looks at, and somebody who's been in a program that hasn't exhaustively looked at theory, particularly literary theory, I found the book to be pretty challenging, even though it's a period that I look at quite a bit in my own research. It's just absent a lot of the major political and even, you know, social scientists, scientific characters that we think about as being these pivotal intellectual figures of the mid-20th century. I want to return to your review because you made what I thought was a very kind of bold, provocative statement in arguing that a book whose title involves the crisis of man is not actually a book that's about man. So could you maybe expound a little bit on what you meant by that in your review?
Sure. I mean, it kind of came about almost as an accident. I was looking closely at some of the titles, not just of his book, but a pattern that appeared, that I felt appeared in a number of the titles of the key texts that he looks at. And the pattern that I found was that to think about, although English doesn't have, it sort of has a declension of nouns, but not as formally as German or Latin or Greek. But what's very interesting is that the word man, which appears in so many of the titles of the text that Greif looks at, very rarely appears as the nominative in the title, but rather more commonly as a genitive or as a dative, of man, to man, or man something or other, right? And that displaces man from the center of these titles, or at least from the subject position, in a very repeated way. And I found that really interesting. I started thinking about his own title, The Age of the Crisis of Man, and of course, of man appears in his title as well. And so I started thinking about the other two terms in his title, age and crisis. And what I started thinking about was the way that his book focuses as well on history, on the shape of history, as he says at one point, as being one of the key dimensions of this discourse of the crisis of man, or this discourse of man. And so I guess perhaps it was a little bit provocative to say that man is not at the center of his book. It is in many, many ways. But I think that that there is a certain concreteness to those other two terms, age and crisis, which man does not have. And he talks very intelligently, I think, about man as what he calls an empty discourse. And he contrasts that with a Kant discourse, sort of dog whistle discourse, where the objective is not to create discussion or to create debate, but to create assent, to sort of induce a reflexive agreement among one's interlocutors. But an empty discourse for him is much more interesting. And an empty discourse is intended to create a proliferation of other answers to a central question. And he talks about this as well in another term that I think people have picked up on and really enjoyed thinking about, which is maieutics, which comes from midwifery. The objective is to produce a response rather than to settle a debate or to strike down an opponent's answer or argument. And so I think that's a very useful way of thinking about this discourse. And it's a useful way, I think, of thinking about many sort of communities of discourse, as not always a sort of combative community, but rather a maieutic community, one that is intended to produce a proliferation of answers. But this notion of empty discourse, I return to again and again. I was thinking, well, I think that captures a certain dimension of this discourse broadly, but there does seem to be something fairly concrete that people are arguing about in a more combative or rivalrous way. And I think that largely has to do with this issue of the shape of history, of whether, of what the crisis of man consists in, as a turning point in history, where is man going? And I think that gives a little bit more meat to the discourse than just these rather abstract questions of man. He talks about, you know, people talking past one another, and I think that is a dimension of the discourse. But people are also shouting one another down in many cases. And I think that may be captured better by issues of historicity or of historicism, of what exactly the nature of history is and where it's going. So that was, I guess, what I was trying to get at in my review.
Well, so I think that brings up, you know, an interesting follow-up point to the types of sources that Greif is using in making this analysis. So, you know, it's easy to kind of put this book in with the other age of books, right? You want to put this in with Howard Brick's Age of Contradictions. You want to put this in with, probably most famously, Daniel Rogers' Age of Fracture. But the kind of source base that Greif is working from is very different than those other two books, which we would think of as more kind of mainstream, mainline intellectual histories that focus on political movements. And when they talk about things like art or fiction, they're kind of side pieces for larger discussions about politics and culture. So what role does fiction play in Greif's book? And why do you think that Greif, besides perhaps, you know, his background as a literature person, why those sources for making this kind of argument about a particular period of American intellectual history?
I think that gets absolutely to the heart of the book, because I think that for him, fiction is the space where some of these rather nebulous, maieutic questions of what the nature of man is, what the condition of man is, are answered most directly. And again, not to get too pedantic about grammar, but it is in the fiction that you see man in the nominative, dangling man, invisible man. A good man is hard to find. Even the man in the gray flannel suit. And to me, I think that is where the discourse fills in. The discourse of man fills in. It's not an empty discourse in the fiction. In the novels that he deals with, I think that there is a real attempt to sort of talk directly to the reader, to address the reader in a way that that I think that some of the intellectuals that he's looking at are not quite capable of doing, or are not intending to do. That they're speaking more from a lectern rather than sort of buttonholing you the way that Saul Bellow can in such a rich and enjoyable way, and also kind of an uncomfortable way in many cases, or that Ralph Ellison can, I think, as well. Both are really able to sort of get in your face in a way that Reinhold Niebuhr does not. I think that he shouts over the top of your head quite often instead of really getting in there. So I think that fiction for Greif is really important as the way to fill in this discourse, to see the sort of gears meshing of the discourse of man. And I think that he is an incredibly talented reader, and a close reader. So I think that, you know, playing to his strengths, that was an obvious place to go. And it turned out an incredible product, that I'm very grateful for, opening up, you know, these very well-read and famous texts in an incredibly rich way. So I think that, you know, it is part of his training, but I think that's also just part of his skill set. So I'm glad that he went that direction instead of, I mean, he's a great reader of philosophical texts as well, but without the fiction there, I think that there would be a missing dimension of what he can really do.
Yeah, and I think what it ends up leading to, which is really interesting, is that instead of kind of using these texts as a way to get at, as other books have, kind of these political movements or foreign relations or something like that, it avoids the kind of political contest and political sparring that he kind of bemoans in the conclusion as being major shapers of intellectual history, which is to say that intellectual history, even though it's supposedly focused on ideas or intellectual climate, oftentimes it corresponds very directly to kind of larger narratives about politics and culture in the 20th century. So that, you know, you have a lot of intellectual histories that obey the kind of 1947 to 1991 Cold War trajectory, for instance, or will, you know, have a chapter that talks about intellectual history during World War II, very much allowing those kinds of global events to shape the way that we think about ideas. And I think Greif kind of wants to get away from that. He wants to say that we should look at ideas in the climate that they exist, or displaced, I mean, from the climate that they exist, and within a kind of intellectual world that is sometimes immune from the kinds of major global events that politics are kind of so often bound up with. He actually has a kind of amusing comment. I can't remember if it's in the introduction or the conclusion, where he talks about kind of World War II and how so many intellectual histories just kind of look at World War II as a dead space. Is that like the conflict was so total that there was no room for intellectual production, or the intellectual production was so insignificant compared to the global events that it wasn't worth mentioning. And he kind of says, well, like no ideas happened between, you know, 1941 and 1945. I think he might overstate that point a little bit because, I mean, there are intellectual histories that talk about the embeddedness of intellectuals in the warfare state, which I think is an important component of intellectual history, is looking at the ways that institutions and ideas are related to one another, and how so often institutions, whether or not they're kind of the university institution or funding institutions, either directly lead to or profoundly shape ideas and their reception. So I think that is a point that's worth mentioning, but it's nice to have this kind of refreshing, it actually strikes me as more of a kind of European intellectual history, something that European scholars would be, European intellectual historians, I should say, would be willing to say, let's put the politics aside, and let's look at the debates between scholars. This is something that's been done and has been highly contested about Heidegger's scholarship, for example. Like, can we put aside Heidegger's politics and talk about his philosophy and his debates with other scholars? Or is that a necessary part of even examining his intellectual production? And this gets at, I think, the point that's kind of puzzled me a little bit looking at this book is, you know, it seemed like a significant book from the outset because it was coming from a prominent N+1 editor who had written a bunch of very well-received, very smart articles. But I was a little bit surprised to see how much traction this book has gotten among intellectual historians, which I don't know if that points to something about the kind of climate of American intellectual history at this current moment, or perhaps the paucity of books discussing fiction as an essential component of intellectual history. But I was wondering kind of why you thought that this book has received so much attention from intellectual historians. I mean, you were one of three reviewers on the intellectual history blog that looked at this book. So why do you think it's gotten so much attention from the intellectual history community?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I think that the sort of background of Greif as an N+1 editor, as somebody that I think a lot of us admire in terms of his initiative to create N+1 and his obvious brilliance in those articles that you mentioned, I think that there was a sense of anticipation that was richly rewarded by reading the actual book. But I think that, I think that you kind of have to look at the position that Greif has in a broader intellectual culture and see that as perhaps the reason why his book stands out and why so many were excited to read it and have been excited to discuss it. I think that, you know, in part it is the sense that he carries on a lineage from some of the figures in his book. The N+1 is maybe not our partisan review, but that if there is anything in the current intellectual climate in the United States that occupies that kind of degree of respect and attention, it would be something like N+1 and a number of other more recent small magazines, little magazines as well. But I think that has a large role in the reception of his book. Is that perhaps hunger among intellectual historians and self-identified intellectuals more broadly in the United States to have those kind of figures or figureheads, not in a ceremonial function, but in an actual leadership function, as somebody to look up to and to be interested in what they have to say. So I think the Greif has secured that position by the quality of his writing over a period of time. And I personally was very excited to see that the book was coming out and that I'd get a chance to read it.
Yeah, you mentioned hunger, and I think that hunger and its corresponding friend anxiety play at least a little bit of a role here. I was reading this book actually at the same time that I was looking at David Armitage's The History Manifesto, and its discussion of this kind of death of the long durée, and the idea that, you know, it's been since kind of disproven that more and more history dissertations are focusing kind of on fewer and fewer years and shorter time spans. And what Greif's book seems to do is it seems to take on this huge scope. It takes on this incredibly ambitious project, especially for a first book. And it's so confident in its execution. It's not kind of concerned, I think, with a lot of the problems, particularly evidentiary problems, that have increasingly faced intellectual historians as there's become a greater expectation that we'll rely on non-published sources. So I think Greif, as a literature person and somebody who's kind of responding to that tradition, the Frederick Jameson tradition, of having a kind of canon of books that you can pull from and not having to feel responsible for every single criticism about archival materials or about other literature that exists outside of the canon. I think it really frees him to tackle an ambitious project that I'm not sure that an American intellectual historian coming in a time when cultural history is so prominent and the feeling is that archival evidence is so central to kind of capturing those voices that were lost in the publication process. It's nice to see a book that seems so kind of unencumbered by those anxieties. And I think that's why it's gotten so much response from intellectual historians. It's like, this is something that maybe more people should be trying to tackle. I really think that that's a big part of why Greif has gotten such a great response in the intellectual history community. And I think it leads to a kind of question of kind of what can intellectual historians take from this book? Is there a future of maieutics as an intellectual history tool in the toolkit? Or is this a kind of singular work that will perhaps kind of stand alone as a continued emphasis on archival evidence drowns out the kind of scholarship that Greif is accomplishing? Like, what do you think about that, Andrew?
Well, I think this, for me, gets back to the issue of Greif's own ambivalence to his source base. His book certainly does not make me want to go and crack one of the two volumes of The Nature and Destiny of Man by Reinhold Niebuhr. He does a thorough job of describing the context of the book and its argument, but there's really not much excitement there in terms of wanting to look myself at these sources and try to see what they have to offer me. And so I think that that ambivalence could possibly make the book in that sense, in terms of the actual content of the book, something of a dead end, which I'm not sure he would feel terrible about. I'm not sure that there is that he feels that there is more work to be done on the discourse of man. Not that I think that he claims for his book an exhaustive quality, but that that perhaps it's just not as fruitful a ground for others to plow. But in terms of the freedom that you're talking about, the liberty that he takes with his sources and assembling a source base, I think that is going to be incredibly inspirational, especially to grad students who are in the early stages of their dissertation research, and I think that it will have quite a large effect. At least I could see it having quite a large effect. It has shaped my work to some extent in terms of making me feel more confident about introducing fiction into some of my chapters. I had already intended to do that, but I felt very nervous about doing so. And so I think that is likely to have continuing effects, continuing repercussions in terms of the way intellectual history is practiced. I think that the real question will be, how other scholars engage with this historiographically. I think that the periodization argument is perhaps the easiest way to really take the book as a point of engagement or a point of departure. I think that in one sense is one of its weaker points. I think that the argument that we need to think of 1945 not or even the war period itself, as you say, as this sort of dead zone, and then everything restarts again or things completely change after the war, but that there are significant continuities. And I think that there are many books that are making that argument concurrently with this. Howard Brooks' other great book, or one of his other great books, Transcending Capitalism, does this very, very effectively. But I think that why 1933 was a question that I had, because so much of the discourse of man that I feel that he's introducing there pre-exists 1933 to a very great extent. Many of the key questions, the concrete questions about man, dictatorship, propaganda, the crowd or the mass, longstanding questions, and he doesn't really acknowledge the prehistory of his tale as well as I think he should have. And so I think that, you know, in those senses, his book may get some engagement from other scholars quibbling with these questions of periodization. But I would love to see more people reading Reinhold Niebuhr. It's not a work that I want to do, but I think that would be great. And obviously, Arendt plays a huge role in his book, and Mumford as well. And those are two standard figures. So I think that we'll probably see, you know, much more work on them, and that will have to acknowledge his interventions. But the idea of the discourse of man, I will be very interested to see how that is taken up in scholarship going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of hopeful on two points that I think that the book is particularly effective in. I think one, bringing fiction back into intellectual history as a major wellspring of source material for the field, and something that can lend valuable insights, not only in this kind of closed intellectual system that Greif introduces, but also of talking about things like, you know, America's relationship to the world post-1945, America's relationship to its own problems with race and gender. I think that these are all very useful areas for fiction, and I think it's somewhere where fiction could make a really powerful contribution to American intellectual history, and one that I think has waned a little bit in recent years, at least in the 5 or 6 years since I've been in graduate school, but I think is primed for a return. The other thing that I think that he does very effectively is use theory to help his argument, and not use theory in a kind of pedantic way of saying, like, I read some important European philosophy, or like I read Derrida, and I'm going to kind of jam it unnecessarily into my introduction and conclusion. But instead, you know, he engages this idea of maieutics, and he uses it very effectively to not only make his argument clearer, but also kind of help give the historian an idea of how methodologically his work differs from what you see, you know, on the rest of your bookshelf. And I think that that's a useful guide for future intellectual historians that really want to engage in theory and want to know how to do it in an effective way that enhances their argument and that clarifies their argument, not unnecessarily complicating it, and provides a kind of framework through which they can bring either archival information or non-archival information into a compelling synthesis. So are there any other kind of points that you want to add or discuss about the book?
Yeah, no, I completely agree that I think that fiction is a really rich place for him to go. One thing that that came up in Patrick Redding's great review on USIH was that fiction's not enough. And I think that's a point that that he makes in his own work, which deals much more with poetry. And so I hope that that Greif really inspires people not to just look at fiction in particular, but also poetry and drama. There are so many rich works that he could have also engaged with. I mean, you know, he engages with a miraculous number of texts, but other things that would have made very pertinent points. I think that if this book inspires grad students to think more broadly about literature as a place to mine some evidence from, I hope that continues out beyond fiction as well.
Okay, wonderful. So that was Mark Greif's book, The Age of the Crisis of Man, Thought and Fiction in America, 1933 to 1973. It's definitely a worthwhile read, and I suggest everybody kind of pick it up either at your local library or local bookstore, Amazon or something. So we'll move on now to the second segment, which is just a very brief segment. So last year, Andrew initiated the first summer book reading group book club that was Mary McCarthy's The Group. Is that right, Andrew?
Yes. Great novel.
So this year we're going to try to do something a little bit different, but similar to past book clubs that we've done for the Society for U.S. Intellectual History, which is that we're going to do a book club over winter break. Andrew has already put up a post for what the book is going to be, and that is going to be John William Stoner, which was originally published in 1965, but is now available in reprint through the New York Review of Books Classics. I can give a brief summary of what the novel is about, taken from the publisher's website, which is that, sent by his hardscrabble farmer father to the University of Missouri to study agriculture, William Stoner is sidetracked by an obsessive love of literature and stimulated by a curmudgeonly old professor, Archer Sloan. Sloan helps Stoner avoid service in World War I, and Stoner eventually becomes an assistant professor. He then meets and marries a St. Louis beauty, Edith, who quickly subjugates her contemplative, passive husband. As decades pass, Stoner entrenches himself deep into the life of the mind, developing into a master teacher, but never finding solace in the outside world. Stoner's single joy is Grace, their daughter, whom Edith appropriates as a weapon in her very personal war against Stoner's quest for inner peace. It's a really wonderful book. I read it a number of years ago, and I think it's something that people on the blog will really enjoy writing about as well as reading about. Andrew will be doing periodic updates on his reading of the book, including what he's finding interesting. And so we look very forward to that.
So that actually concludes the inaugural Society for U.S. Intellectual History podcast. I'm Matthew Linton. You can reach out to me either through the Society for U.S. Intellectual History Facebook page or through my Twitter handle, which is @Linton_Matt. That's @Linton, LINTON underscore Matt. You can also contact Andrew Seal through the blog. And do you have any other ways for us to get in touch with you, Andrew?
Sure. I'm on Twitter as well. I think my handle is just Andrew underscore Seal, but I'm hopeful that you can find me if it's not. I guess it's not something that I look at an awful lot. I mean, I look at Twitter an awful lot, but I don't look at my handle. So hopefully you'll find me.
Great. So yeah, definitely look us up and give us feedback, what you think about this first podcast, ways we can improve, subjects you'd like to hear about. And we look forward to giving you more discussion about topics in U.S. intellectual history in the future. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Andrew Seal. I'm a PhD candidate in American Studies at Yale University. I'm delighted to be joining you.